Our next guest on Downtown burst onto the music scene with that song in 1988. It became a top 20 hit, one of the great songs of the 80s. He's been making wonderful music for many, many years and is working on a new album called Save Your Love For Me. We are so happy to be joined this afternoon by Grayson Hugh. Grayson, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Rich. Nice to be with you today.
Well, it's good to know we have a friend in common out there. Actually, Don Netto, Don Morgan, does the opening for our show every day.
Ah, what do you know? It's a small world, in the world of music, especially.
It sure is, definitely. Well, let's talk about this new album you've been working on for a while that seems to pull together so many of your different musical loves. Talk a little bit, if you can, about Save Your Love For Me.
Right. I've always liked country and real old roots country, bluegrass, and I always used to call bluegrass mountain soul because to me that's what it is. Mm. Great harmonies, the great syncopation. It's that combination of black music with really what you call hillbilly, mountain music, and that's what it is. I mean, it's never exactly that, but I wanted to make a lot of my songs. I wanted to make a record that they'd find a home on, that were not really what I'm sort of more known for, which is the soul. So I said, well, I want to get some great musicians, and I thought about it and made some calls, and I put together a band I'm very excited about. I got Bob Dylan's bass player, Tony Garnier, who I had never actually worked with before, but he knew some mutual friends, and got him to play upright, mostly upright, a little electric, but mostly upright bass. Got a guitar player named Pete Kennedy, who of the Kennedys, his wife Maura, have a great duo that they do, and he's played with everybody from Mamie Lou Harris to Nancy Griffith to Frank Sinatra, but a lot of roots people. And then on Dobro, I had worked with this woman before, Cindy Cashdollar, and she's just a wonderful musician. She plays great lap steel and Dobro, and so she, she came down and did her parts, and then I got a fiddler, Gary Oliar, who's been with Loggins and Messina for many years, and I knew him before. So, and then my wife, Polly Messer, on harmony, vocals, and myself doing what I do, mostly acoustic piano and, some other little rootsy things. We started recording it a year ago, and then, of course, this whole pandemic hit at the beginning. Well, it seems like the beginning was actually March. So we kind of got shut down, and we're in the middle of it. But all the rhythm tracks are done, and I just am waiting to get back into the studio, and I'm very excited about it.
I understand there's quite a story behind the title song for the album, too.
Right. Save Your Love For Me is... it's basically when I moved to Manhattan, when I got signed to RCA way back in 1987, I had to be there. So I moved from Connecticut to New York, and I had a girlfriend at the time who was living down in Georgia, real country, middle of nowhere. And, of course, I missed her, and she missed me, and so I got to thinking about, I sort of went from there, imagine going down and, it was not a midnight train that I took, but it sounded good for the lyrics. But that's what it is, basically, like a lot of my songs, it's written from my own experience.
One of the things you're doing, too, to help finance the brand new album is that you've put together some great packages of DVD packages of some of your videos.
Right. That's right, Rich. I got actually a fan. I have the greatest fans. And one guy suggested, why don't I sell some of my videos? So I actually know a little bit about editing. And not that I'm editing the official videos, but I'm got together some of my own videos from, you know, the hits that I've had. And then I also had a couple of early bands, one of which was with my wife when we were just friends way back in 1982, Gracie New and the Wild Zones. Connecticut Public Television had a series not unlike the Austin, Texas
Austin City Limits
series. Yeah. So, you know, I have two, you know, shows that I did with that and a band even a year earlier. So, and I meant some other packages. And that's, you know, kept the sort of, you know, steady income going that during this time that, you know, I've been able to, you know, just helps to live on and also to continue to finance the finishing of the record. So, yeah. You have to be think outside the box sometimes.
No question about
that.
To
make a living when you're an artist, when you're a musician.
We're talking with Grayson Hugh here on Downtown. Let's go back a little bit. And you mentioned your love of country and bluegrass, but you grew up in the country hotbed of West Hartford, Connecticut.
That's right.
Your
the
dad
wilds of the suburbs.
Well, I was born in Hartford myself, and you're And your dad was a classical music radio host, right?
Yes, he was. He got the radio bug. He was from Britain, moved over when he was a teenager, and right before World War II, he joined the Merchant Marine at the end of the war. As he said, he didn't want to kill anybody, but he wanted to do his bit, you know? So he became a Sparks, a radio operator, and he always said that's when he caught the radio bug. So he, ever since then, he was a radio, classical music radio DJ, and he would bring home rock and roll 45s that people would send him. And, you know, he couldn't play it on his show. And that's how, really, me and my brothers got introduced to some great music, early Elvis, you know, Fats Domino, the Everly Brothers. And that was a real interesting a side benefit of his job that I benefited.
And you learned to play pretty young, and it sounds like you're getting a lot of your musical influences too by playing for all kinds of different people in a lot of different settings.
Right. I mean, I took classical piano, I studied jazz piano, I studied alto saxophone, and I, you know, really came from a classical background, which has benefited me. I'm able to arrange and. And a lot of times, rock musicians don't necessarily really read music all that well. Some do. Some are really well-versed. But it's also been a way for me to do other things, like compose for some modern dance companies. Mm-hmm. When I was teaching songwriting at Berklee in Boston, some dance companies hooked up with me, commissioned me to write some scores for them. I've always enjoyed doing that, and also did some television and a film, you know, scoring. It's good to be a little versatile like that.
Absolutely. So you moved to New York City in the 80s. How did you get together with Michael Baker?
That is the elevator story. Whenever I tell this, people just can't believe it. You're making that up, but it really is true. Before I got signed, I knew I wanted a record deal. It was like 1986, and I was, you know, playing in my bands in Connecticut and Hartford area, and I just was bored with, you know, I really wanted a record deal. And I was pretty sure that I could get it. But I had to go to, where am I going to go? I thought of L.A. Or Nashville, but I'm not really country. At that time, I definitely was not. London, well, you know, that's kind of far away. So I just chose New York, the next big city. So that's what I did. And I just, you know, was pounding on doors the old-fashioned way. One day, the woman, actually, she was an ex-girlfriend. She was living in New York, and she had agreed to be my manager. Really, I didn't know anyone except her in New York City. So I had just left her apartment, was coming down on the elevator, and Michael Baker, this guy was who I didn't know, was going up to visit his girlfriend who lived in the same building. And we were in the elevator for a couple floors going, you know, talking. He saw that I was carrying a synthesizer, and he said, "Oh, you're a musician." And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, I'm a producer." And I said, who you produced? And he said, "Well, the Blow Monkeys. I'm just finishing up their record." And I had just seen the thing on MTV about them. A bunch of white kids in the south of London that love soul music. And I said, "Oh, yeah." And so I invited him up to hear some music. I played him my tapes, and he did not believe that was me. And then he said, "Prove it by performing live." My manager had a piano. So I did. And then he's pointing to his forearm, and I go, what does that mean? And he said he was showing his goosebumps. And the story goes is that he told his girlfriend, "I just discovered the next Buddy Holly." This is what he said. He told her. So I was, you know, he said, "You don't have a record deal. I can get you one if you sign with me a production deal." And true to his word, he hired me to sing backup vocals with the Blow Monkeys on the album. She Was Just a Grocer's Daughter. And from there, we demoed some songs, and RCA signed me.
Well,
that's the Michael Baker elevator story.
I was a radio program director at the time, and every Tuesday was record day, new record day, new releases.
Right.
And you'd open up and you give a little listen, and I remember popping on the turntable a song called Talk It Over, and it blew me away. I said, "My God, Sam Cooke has come back from the dead," but it sounded like absolutely, but it sounded like nothing that was on the radio. It was so unique, so original, so soulful, and just so beautifully arranged, and with an incredible vocal performance.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate that. I've always been an imitator, and I grew up listening to a lot of different soul musicians besides the classical music, like Ray Charles, first album I ever bought, and the singers, and I was just go around I would sing like that, and I just loved it. And then of course the Beatles came along, and the Motown and the soul singers like Wilson Pickett and Joe Tex. Yeah, but all along there was the country thing that I loved too, like Conway Twitty and Hank Williams Sr. So music is music. It's just good music is good music.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because the album I remember listening to the most as a little kid, before anybody told me what his genre was Ray Charles, Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music.
Oh, what a great album. Yes. What a great record.
Well, the album Blind to Reason produced three different hits for you. From my money, I love Blind to Reason, but I loved Road to Freedom even more. Billboard had it as one of their top albums of the year, but as so often happens, record company politics get in the way and kept you from having what should have been a heck of a lot more hits from that album.
Yes, they were clueless, I have to say. They just dropped the ball. And what happened is the guy that had signed me, my second record was going to be on RCA. Started recording it. I chose a guy named Bernard Edwards to produce it. One of the founding members of Sheik, along with Nile Rodgers, because I liked his approach of soul and rock. Yeah, and I started rehearsing, started recording. RCA was thrilled, but they did this thing called musical presidents. They started doing that. And I went from one guy jumping up and down, actually physically in the studio, saying, "I love, this is the best thing, I love this." And they invited a Rolling Stone guy over to interview me, a guy named David Wild. And, it was about to take off, really, with a lot of support in RCA. Suddenly, they changed presidents. And that's the politics, the people say, "I don't hear the single," that old, nonsense. So I had to go and do some more writing. And they were just dragging their heels. So my managers at the time said, "Look, we're going to find a label that appreciates you more." So that's how I wound up in MCA. And they turned out to be a lot worse. I should have just stayed with RCA. But, you just don't know.
But the good news was the album did get the attention of director Ridley Scott.
Yes. That was a very lucky thing. And I don't really believe that much in luck, Rich. I think there's a power out there that is at work. You know, it works through people, and call it what you will. But, I heard one day that my managers, these two English guys, one of them called me and said, Ridley Scott is flying around the world saying he discovered Grace and Hugh. And he wanted to use like four songs in the movie off of Road to Freedom. So we couldn't do that because then the people could just not, they wouldn't have to buy the album. They could just get the soundtrack. So we gave him two. And, you know, it was a really great break for me to be featured in that film. And then the next couple months after that, the director of Fried Green Tomatoes asked me to record a Bob Dylan song called I'll Remember You. So then for that, I went back to my gospel piano playing days in a little black church in Hartford. And when I was in my teens, and I arranged it like that and got some great music. Actually, it was Eric Clapton's band, everybody except Clapton, that recorded that, and then some great gospel singers. And that was another great opportunity. And again, just being at the right place at the right time, that power that is working, the linking creative people up together, that sometimes it really works well. So I was very fortunate to get that.
You relocated.
Great. I like both of those movies. Real, you know, tearjerker, Fried Green Tomatoes.
You relocated to North Carolina for a while. And then, as you mentioned, back to New England. You taught at Berkeley for a while. Did you ever run into a friend of our show, Livingston Taylor, when you were at Berkeley?
No, he was actually after my tenure there. And you don't really, a lot of times, see each other. The faculty people, everyone's doing their own thing. I did work with a couple of people, the drummer Kenwood Denard, who has played with everybody from Dizzy Gillespie to James Brown. I mean, he's just phenomenal. And some other people, Tom Stein, you know, but, you know, that was a kind of a hard time for me because my mom had just been diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2000. And, you know, I had always had a problem with drinking, but I stopped drinking in 1980. And 20 years I hadn't had a drop. And I knew I was an alcoholic because my uncles were a lot of them, not my father, not my parents. But I think the stress of knowing I was going to lose our mother, you know, that's a death sentence, unfortunately. And just being lonely and just, you know, I didn't really know how to not, you know, succumb to the temptation. And I just escaped into the bottle. And I was able to teach somehow for, you know, another year and a half. But eventually it caught up with me. And it becomes obvious, though you're thinking you're fooling people. And I was fired, which was, of course, the appropriate thing to happen. And, you know, my life started to get smaller and smaller. I ended up in a room above a bar in Cape Cod. You know, that's really, you know, what it was. And I ended up having a seizure, alcoholic seizure, and a blackout. And I was in bad shape. Wound up in the hospital, and from there, a bed opened up in a sober house. And for 3 years, I rebuilt my life from at the age of 54, you know, in 2004. And it was the best thing that could have happened to me because that gift of desperation forced me to take care of that problem.
And you did that, and then got back to music, made your first album, which I think was an American record. What, first album in almost 15 years?
That's right, exactly. One of the a counselor that was you'd visit with sometimes, he was a fan. He said, "Look, I'm going to break your anonymity. I know who you are, and in fact, I want you to sign these two, you know, CDs." But he was a great guy, Dean Gilmore, wonderful man. We started being friends, and we'd trade books. And he got his agency to get some seed money to get me, you know, back to doing what I do best, which is to make music and record a record, more specifically. So it took 5 years to release it, but that's what happened, you know. And I owe so much to him. He passed away, unfortunately. As a result of making that, I re-met my good old friend Polly Messer, who we had always been. She was married to a good friend of mine, actually, and we were all friends. And she found out, she didn't know where I was, but sent a letter to me through my brother. And we started talking, and I had done rhythm tracks at a studio in Concord and started doing overdubs. Still living at the sober house in Cape Cod, actually Wareham, Massachusetts, taking the bus down to Hartford, doing overdubs at my guitar player's house. She started doing, I said, I don't have any money. I have just enough to pay these musicians. She said, I'll sing for free. So, wow, how can I refuse that? And I kept writing her into more and more songs because I was falling in love with her. And plus, she's a phenomenal, phenomenal singer. So that, after about, really 3 months, I asked her to marry me. And amazingly, she said yes. I still can't believe it. Lots of good things happen as a result of being sober.
The new album is called Save Your Love for Me. You can get more information, go to Grayson's website at graysonhugh.net. It's so good to talk with Grayson. I've been a fan of your music for 30-plus years now. You have one of the most unique voices in all of music. We wish you much success with the new album, and I hope you'll come back and visit with us once it's released.
I'd love to. It'd be nice to do it in person.
Absolutely.
Back up there to Bangor.
Live music, again, will be a good thing for all of us. No question about
yes,
that.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Grayson. Appreciate it.
As they say,
Thank you, Grayson.
Thank you, Rich.